You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Coercive control is something we've only just begun to hear about. When people think about domestic abuse, their imaginations often limit their understanding to the overt violence. But abuse is more complicated than that. Psychological and emotional abuse is often what keeps women from leaving and can torment them even more than the physical blows. Jennifer 42 is a feature-length animated documentary that tells the true story of Jennifer Magnano, a Connecticut mother of three who spent 15 years in a brutally abusive marriage and attempted to escape with her family. The film delves into the nature of coercive control and explores broader cultural forces at play. I recently spoke with the director of the film, L. Kamihira, and co-producer Laura Richards, a criminal behavioral analyst and the producer of Dirty John, The Dirty Truth, another story of a man who used coercive control to exploit and abuse women. Here's an interview. People often understand domestic abuse in a particular and pretty limited way. Like, they'll imagine the issue as just being straight violence, and often don't realize the psychological complexities at play. What do you think are some of the key ways people misunderstand domestic abuse? Maybe you can start, Laura.
Yeah, so I mean, I think lots of people do think domestic violence, and we use the term domestic violence, domestic abuse interchangeably, or I certainly do in training, because if you talk about violence, then people don't think about the abuse. And if you think about the abuse, then you don't think about the seriousness of the violence. Now, and of course, when homicides happen, these are the cases that are much more likely to result in murder. And I would say they're the most dangerous of cases, and I call them murder in slow motion for a reason. And again, when the homicides are reported, they often don't talk about all the history that went before it. So the key thing really, you know, to try and help people understand is that it's not just the physical. It's actually from working with survivors for 20 plus years now, they say to me that the non-physical is the worst. The psychological aspects, the emotional, the entrapment, the laying down rules and regulations of what you can and can't do, and the fear of the consequence if you don't do that, and the double standards. So the rules are set for oftentimes the victim, the female victim, and if they don't comply, then a fear of consequence, something terrible will happen to them. And it's this domination and not allowing someone to reach their full potential as a human being. And I think, you know, it's certainly important to understand it's gradual and happens over time. And that's why I think it's much more like a liberty crime. It's an erosion of someone's confidence, their self-esteem, their agency, their autonomy. And that's why coercive control and understanding that term coercive control is much more appropriate when we understand that domestic abuse, domestic violence is a power and control crime.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to add to that, Elle?
Yeah, I just want to add that I think people also understand domestic violence or domestic abuse as kind of an out of control rage problem and not as a, you know, kind of strategy to dominate, and that, you know, that they don't think about it as a thought through kind of tactic. They think about it as an out of control person who, you know, can be, you know, could he only rein in his temper, things would be good. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what domestic violence is.
Mm-hmm.
Just to build on that, I do think, you know, that's where the media do play a role. And, you know, when they report on it in a way that, A, it happens in a vacuum, and it's just behind closed doors, and it's an isolated incident, in inverted commas, then people don't really understand that actually someone using a power and control dynamic, it's normally well thought through. It's not in red mist. And of course, now we're seeing it spill out onto the streets in America in particular with the mass shootings. And now people are paying attention. And too often I'm saying, and when I go on CNN or talk, I would say, please don't mention the shooter, because that's what they're seeking to achieve. And normally this is an ongoing domestic abuse situation, and it's now spilled out onto the streets or into a school or into a particular area. So I think it's really important people make those links as well, that someone who uses a power and control dynamic doesn't just do it on one person. They will select their victim. And it is, as Al said, it's very much a strategic way of operating. And it's not about anger management, or it's when they drink, or it's when they do drugs. So there's lots of kind of myths and stereotypes that people have in their head, or that they see reported, or even on TV shows, that they think domestic abuse is something very different, actually, than what it really is. And it is about terrorism, in its simplest term, about a domestic terrorist who literally psychologically undoes their victim and replaces their narrative in their head with the perpetrator's narrative. And that's a sophisticated process that doesn't happen overnight.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's only been pretty recently that we've been hearing about coercive control, that term, that, you know, this has been getting covered in the media and people are writing about it and talking about it. So, but, you know, still probably a lot of people haven't heard the term or don't really understand what it means. So what is coercive control?
Well, having changed the law on it and spearheaded that campaign in England and Wales, which was the first country in the world to take effective action and to say, look, it's a pattern of behaviour. It's not just a one-off incident. And again, people talk about these things as if it's a one-off thing. It's a pattern, and it's serious, and it's serious enough because we know it connects with lethality. So this is where women and girls are much more likely to be murdered. And so what I was showing is overwhelming evidence in England and Wales, with many survivors, their voices at the centre of the campaign, working with Women's Aid and Sarah Charlton Foundation and my charity Paladin, the National Stalking Advocacy Service. We showed that it was something that was serious. We showed that there was a gap in legislation and the law. And we also defined it as well to help people in terms of practical points to prove within the legislation. And as Elle already said, it is a strategic pattern of behaviour. It's exploitative of somebody. It is isolating. So isolation is the tool that the perpetrator uses. It can prevent the victim from accessing resources or having their needs met. And it limits their potential in terms of what they can do. And it's really akin to brainwashing. So an abuser creates this codependency and changes the victim's, you know, the adult victim, more often than not, their likes, their dislikes, their politics, their worldviews, their ethics, their morals, and replaces that with the perpetrators. So in essence, in terms of the legislation in England and Wales, you have to have two behaviours, a course of conduct. You prove the pattern of behaviour, and you prove the impact that it has on a victim. And there are lots of tactics that a perpetrator may use in order to create domination and subordination in a victim. And it's idiosyncratic to that victim. It's very personal to that victim. So they would take their likes, their dislikes, they would take their vulnerabilities, and they will seek to exploit them and create isolation. So it's very difficult to say it's just one thing, because it is very dependent on what the relationship is about. Although we do know that some of the behaviours we see across many of the cases, which, when, you know, if we talk about red flags, what are some of the warning signs? I'll explain that in a little bit more detail of what are the behaviours to look out for. But it is a gradual process over time.
Yeah, I mean, that was the next question I wanted to ask was, you know, how does that work? You know, how can somebody change the likes, dislikes, ethics, beliefs of another person? You know, how would someone go about doing that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And again, when we think about it in isolation without talking about a case or a particular person, then it becomes much more, you know, something that's textbook. But if we talk about someone in particular, let's take the case of Dirty John, the show that sort of lifted the lid on coercive control, where Deborah Newell, it was a podcast first, Deborah Newell came into the line of sight of John Meehan via online dating. And she had dated and been married before, and a number of the dates had been disastrous that she'd been on. And when she met John Meehan, who said that he was an anaesthetist and looked respectable, was a good-looking guy, very charming, he ticked every box. And I remember Deborah specifically saying he was too good to be true. And I always say, well, when someone's too good to be true, there's a warning right there. You should ask questions. And John started love bombing Deborah from very early on, from date number one, of a strategic pattern of behavior to make her fall in love with him. So the flowers, all the things that Deborah had said she wanted in a relationship, he mirrored. And he was very exacting in his campaign to win her heart. And he actually did everything he possibly could to enhance her life to start with. And there were a number of red flags, but Deborah chose to ignore them. And I'm using that language because she and I have talked about it many times. She chose to ignore the red flags, which we do when we really do want to think the best of someone, or we do want to fall in love. And it's very intoxicating when we fall in love or when somebody seems to be the ideal person. Chemically, we release dopamine. There's neurotransmitters and there's hormones that are released as well. It's not just a one-dimensional transaction. And so John had ingratiated himself in every aspect of her life, and he seemed to be enhancing her and lifting her up. But all the while, when she said he was so attentive, he was data mining, trying to find out her likes, her dislikes, what went wrong in previous relationships, her secrets, you know. And he would say things like, come on, Deb, people think, you know, you kind of walk with this air as if you're the be all and end all. Some people think you're arrogant. Come on, you must have something, you know, some skeleton in your closet. Come on, share with me, level with me. And so she would. She would tell him things, and then he would weaponize those things. But that would happen over time. So he was too good to be true. He charmed her, and charm is a tactic, and it's a choice. It's not a trait that we're born with. And charm really does disarm people. And he gaslit her. So it's a reality distortion of making you think one thing when it's really another, and isolating her. But all in the guise of in her best interest. And so she fell in love with him very quickly. And that really is sort of the aphrodisiac. That's the intoxication. And then once someone feels they have you under control, it's then that the rules and regulations start to come in. It's subtle things to begin with. It's not big things. And gradually they start to undo everything about you, even in terms of your relationships, either inserting in the relationships, taking over the relationships, or turning people against each other, or just isolating under the guise that it's in your best interest. But they will be manipulating you and people around you and setting people either in conflict with you, and you may not even know why people stop ringing. But with Deborah, he had conflict with her two daughters. And in the end, Deborah didn't have any of her family around her. And he kept saying, when they're around, you know, there are tensions. It's not in your interest, Deb. You know, let me take care of you. So it's a very slow process and a dance in time, in really until that person feels that they have control over you. And then you're heavily invested. It might be financially, it might be you're pregnant. Dependency will be there. And then it's very hard, not impossible, but hard to get out of that relationship.
Yeah. I just want to add to that, too, that I think it's important to remember that coercive control is largely a male pattern crime. Would you agree, Laura?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that, you know, the tactics or strategies that are used by male abusers are, you know, kind of baked into female roles. You know, both the entrapment process and the, you know, kind of hostage taking is very, you know, kind of based on in women's roles in the home and the sort of romantic dreams and, you know, the things that we're conditioned to expect and want and dream of. And so I think it's important to remember that there's kind of like a foundation here, like a male, female, a gendered foundation to this, to these abuses.
Right. And I mean, while So you talk about this kind of behavior as being strategic and planned and intentional, but do you think that there's also a learned aspect to it? Do you think that some of these men are doing this not necessarily consciously, but because this is how they've learned to behave towards women to a certain extent? Or do you think it's always sort of more thought out and planned and intentional than that?
You know, that's a great question, and people have asked that. And the more I examine and think about the patriarchy, the more I think that it's in the, you know, it's everywhere. It's like the weather. And it's very hard to, it's kind of like in the DNA, you know, as we're socialized when we're little, in terms of, you know, male, female, and that socialization of, and now sort of nudged on it, the what's expected of gendered roles. And what does it mean to be a man, and how should a man behave to a woman? And, you know, the stuff that we talk about now around toxic masculinity. But one thing's for sure with behavior, if you do something and it keeps getting you what you want, then you're rewarded. And therefore, if it keeps getting you that thing, you just carry on doing it until someone or something bigger than you says stop. And there is a negative consequence, and a consequence that you fear or that you don't want happening. And that will alter the behavior. But, you know, when we think about people, I've just finished Untouchable, the Harvey Weinstein documentary. Have either of you seen it?
No, not yet. I can't wait.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just say I'm feeling pretty enraged today and fired up, because, you know, it's not just about one person doing something. It's about all the people who enable that behavior. And therefore, it's not just about that one person. It's about all of us and being upstanders rather than bystanders and ignoring things or accepting the narrative. Well, boys will be boys, or she slept with him to get that role, rather than did he force her and coerce her into a position? And, you know, too often the narrative is much more around the woman's behavior rather than the abuser's behavior. So I think it's a combination of both. I think that, you know, how we educate young children about what's a healthy relationship is a really big missing piece right now. We talk about the biomechanics of sex, but we don't talk to them about what's a healthy relationship. And jealous and controlling behavior is not healthy. But too often young girls are saying to me, well, he calls me 50 times. That shows that he cares. Well, no, it doesn't. It shows that he's trying to control. So again, how we understand what's healthy and what's not. And I do think, you know, a very basic aspect is if it gets you what you want, and if you prey on people's vulnerabilities and exploit them, and you exploit them so your needs are constantly met, and it gets you what you want, and no one challenges you, you become God in your own world. Now, whether that's on a micro level or on a macro level, like someone like Harvey Weinstein, who actually said he was like God, the sheriff in New York City, that he made the rules up. And the same as R. Kelly, he was God in his own world, and no one challenged him. And then when women did try and speak out, they were silenced and silenced and silenced. So, you know, I think it's complex, because it is about certainly on the basis of the one hand, it's if you keep doing it and it gets you what you want, you get rewarded. You know, when we think about children and how we socialize them, but also the very fact that so many people just accept that behavior is okay when it's not behind closed doors and it's out in the open. And that's what we need to change. And the Me Too movement is the start, I hope, and it's certainly not the end.
Yeah, no, I think also important to remember that we're talking about this for the very first time ever in our lifetimes. And I think it's really just the beginning of the Me Too movement, that is the beginning of a really a wave that just probably won't stop. And I think eventually it will get to the much kind of darker realities of domestic violence and violence against women that kind of darken our lives in a much more, I don't want to say more serious than Me Too, but I think Me Too being the kind of workplace harassment aspect of it, that, you know, when you roll that back, you see other aspects of kind of the diminishment and threat to women, and you'll find domestic violence right in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, it is right there, and that's the thing. It's an invisible thing. And, you know, that's something that I feel strongly about, in that, you know, we say it's workplace violence, or we say it's campus-based violence, or it is stalking, and we give it another name. But what it is, it's a tightly held secret of male violence and abuse to women. And it happens in the home and outside the home. And that's something, you know, when you analyze a lot of the cases, which is what I do, you see those interconnections, that somebody who's seeking power and control doesn't just do it in one setting. They would do it in the settings that allow them to get away with it, but they would do it to significant women and women that are not significant to them. And that's really a join up, given that it's a power and control crime. That's what motivates it. The craving and need for power. When someone feels less than, they try and create more than. And it's normally women who are the target. And of course, the secret is held by many, and the silence and the secrecy colludes with the perpetrator and allows them to get away with it. So the speaking out is really important, really powerful. But of course, even with Harvey Weinstein, it took decades to get some women to go on record. And Ronan Farrow was incredible. But he had threats to his life for doing that. You know, they pursued him, and I won't go into all the details of it, but, you know, challenging powerful people and domestic violence offenders is a dangerous game, but there's the safety in numbers and really giving people a voice and empowering them. A lot of my work's about empowering people not to be silenced and to speak out and to believe them and support them and empower them when they do, and hold perpetrators to account.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, to go back to what you were saying a little bit earlier, I think one of the problems with this, and the inability of us as a society to recognize and address coercive control, is that a lot of these behaviors are kind of subtle and normalized. Like you said, you know, the way that we understand romantic relationships and the way that we're socialized to relate to one another in heterosexual relationships in particular. But, you know, I think women often feel like, you know, they've been socialized to be empathetic and understanding, and you don't necessarily want to paint someone in entirely negative light. You know, you don't want to stereotype someone. So I think often when we start seeing these behaviors, you know, these subtle attempts and efforts to dominate, to make a woman feel insecure, to not trust herself, you know, those jealous behaviors that, you know, become really controlling behaviors, you know, ensuring or ensuring that a woman doesn't see certain of her friends, and sort of controlling the way she acts in public and things like that. And then, you know, and then you're already in it. And I think the way that, you know, when women talk about this, the way that people reflect back to them is really important, because I think other people play a really big role in normalizing that behavior in too, and being like, oh, well, you know, he means well, he cares about you, he seems really nice, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're really powerful observations, because I think that so much of it is normed, and it goes back to, you know, what is a healthy relationship? And you know, making it clear what one looks like. Because I think oftentimes, of course, when children come from homes where there's abuse, it's very hard to understand that that's not normal. And some will go on to carry on that patterning of behavior, and some will learn helplessness, you know, and some with an intervention will get out of it and safely be able to make much better choices and have better relationships in the future. But I think the normalization of it that we see, you know, even with stalking, what's romantic and what's stalking, people still get confused, and people still joke about stalking. And, you know, I think that there's so much to unpack just in language alone. You know, and an example is even the term violence against women and girls. That implies that it's passive, that it just happens. Well, it doesn't just happen. So, you know, a lot of what I look at right now is language, and how language removes an abuser from, and normally it's the male abuser, from the narrative. So, you know, if we take John Meehan and Deborah, you know, John abused Deborah And then it goes to Deborah was abused by John. And then Deborah was abused. And then Deborah was a victim of domestic abuse and stalking. And before long, John's left the conversation. And I can certainly say my own experience of just trafficking on social media after I interviewed Chris Goffard, the LA Times journalist, and said to him, you know, this case is about coercive control. And I explained what it was because he said, I've never heard of it, Laura. And he said, and if I had, I probably would have told this story differently. And I said, wow. You know, and that's the key thing about men telling women stories is that we have to have the nuanced detail. But so many people started writing on social media, well, Deborah should have done this and how dare she do that? And she put her children at risk and blaming and shaming her. And I'm feeling quite entitled to do that. And as I kept saying, the podcast is called Dirty John. It's about John Meehan's behavior exploiting many, many women and abusing many, many women. And it's not called Bad Decision Making Deborah. And I think so often, I say that tongue in cheek, but it's just the fact that we, in our stories and in our narratives, we miss out who really is committing the violence. And that's what is happening right now with mass shooters, you know, where we're seeing trends, statistics coming out, and some brilliant papers that are written by colleagues of mine who are fantastic. And a great paper article went into the LA Times about the top sort of four commonalities that mass shooters, you know, what they have in common. One was that they've had violence or abuse in the home. So we get a connection there. The other was they reached a crisis point. The third is that they sought validation through their action. And the fourth is that they had the means to carry out their plan. Well, what about the number one thing is that they're all male and most of them are white males who are committing this type of mass homicide. And there's a connection with domestic violence and stalking. So again, what goes out means that you miss some of the key narrative about the most dangerous of cases and the most dangerous of people. We do have to talk about male violence and not make excuses for it, that it's because they're abused as a child or they lost their job or they got pressure at work or they weren't feeling well. All the narratives that excuse it. So I know I'm being a bit fiery, but I feel very fired up about this because there's so much just in the language of how we change the narrative and excuse perpetrators, male perpetrators who commit this, you know, domestic abuse and stalking and coercive control and serial killers and sexual violence and mass shooters. This is a male problem and it should be called male violence rather than, you know, and it is a boys and men's issue. It's not a women's issue. And we keep trying to rectify it as women and tackle it, but it's men that need to be changing it and challenging it. Sorry, that's a long rant.
That's okay. It's an important rant. So I wanted to talk about this film that you both have been working on, Jennifer 42, which tells the story of a case of extreme coercive control and the inability of the system to understand and address it, never mind identify it as something that puts women in danger or could be criminal. Who is Jennifer and why did you choose her as a subject for this documentary?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, sure. So Jennifer of Jennifer 42 is Jennifer Magnano. She was a Connecticut mother of three. As a director, I set out to make a sort of status of domestic violence, data-driven documentary about, you know, just kind of what the numbers were and where we were since the 70s and so forth. And I came across the term coercive control for the first time some years ago and kind of dug deeper into the subject and talk about language, I interviewed Dr. Evan Stark as part of my research, and who literally wrote the book on coercive control. And his detailed explanation of this behavior decoded for me something I had kind of always known as a woman, but had never been able to name or quantify. That was the whole thing of that it's not about an out of control rage problem, but it's a strategic method to control someone. And I kind of latched on to that concept and wondered how do you tell the story? How do you convey this pattern of behavior, and how to convey what happens in the household and how this all plays out and unfolds? And so he handed me an investigative report of a murder in Connecticut that had been written by a very intrepid lawyer, Michelle Cruz, who was head of Connecticut's victim advocate office at the time. So I read this report, and I just knew that I had to tell this story, because inside the report was a very detailed report of not only a case of extreme coercive control, but kind of the, you know, she Jennifer Magnano and her kids escaped successfully, which not a lot of women do. They, you know, I think the average is, you know, 7 or 8 times for a victim of domestic violence to try to escape or leave before they actually do. And so she had escaped exactly once and successfully, but the report sort of detailed the down the rabbit hole aftermath of her escape, where she kind of met with a completely uncomprehending first line responders and a system that just didn't understand what was happening to her, what danger she was in, or anything else about the situation, the damage she and the kids had sustained, and so forth. And so the film is about that very much, but it's also so the film is told by, is voiced by Jennifer's surviving children, Jessica, David, and Emily, who are now grown. And, you know, they're, you know, very intimate interviews that paint a extremely detailed picture of 15 years of this coercively controlling house, you know, coercively controlled household developed, sort of, you know, as Laura will attest to, each abuser have their own very unique behaviors and the unique ways that they control. And I think the specifics of that is what I was interested in as a director. And so I, through the kids, paint this very vivid picture of a dad who, you know, started out, went from, you know, a happily married family to a complete, you know, a torture chamber that no one could escape. And sort of the whole evolution of that, how he, you know, slowly, gradually took control of and you know, micromanaged every part or every aspect of their lives, down to how they brushed their teeth and how they washed their hands and how to handle things in the refrigerator and how to flip a light switch, and they couldn't, you know, where they could go in the house and who they could be with and when they could, you know, move about, and their mobility, their economy. And Jennifer, of course, was the, you know, main target of his control. And he destroyed her, you can say. He destroyed her psychologically and emotionally and physically over a period of 15 years. And so when she, you know, had it not been for the fact that she had escaped and had this sort of crazy aftermath to her story, she would have just been another statistic and another you know, untold domestic violence homicide, which happens three a day in this country, I believe. And so, but
it's now 4 a day, actually, Elle. Rachel Louise Snyder updated me and said that the stat is now 4 a day.
Yeah. So this is
Terrible.
a her story is, you know, completely routine in many ways. But because we have this inside view of her life and what happened to her, we get this you know, sort of rare insight into how a relationship like this develops. And yeah, so I think it's just a film that we all stand to learn so much from. It didn't end well, and that's part of the, you know, that's part of the story. We do connect the dots and you know, this kind of to connect the events and the decisions and the actions or misstep by authorities that directly led her into harm's way. Or, and when I say harm's way, I mean within the reach of her ex-husband who murdered her.
Yeah, I mean, this project really spoke to me, and bringing Jennifer 42 to the screen is a really important project. And Elle's outlined some of it. It is a true crime documentary, but it's an animated true crime documentary. And there's never been anything like this before in this space. And everything I've learned about my career, it's about storytelling and how you tell stories and how you educate people and how you influence and change the narrative. And I do think women need to tell stories that they where we understand the nuanced detail far better because it happens to us. And Jennifer Magnano, well, she could be any one woman anywhere. And because of the animation, I think it talks on a very different level, actually, to people. Whether you're young, whether you're old, doesn't matter what nationality you are. It's beautifully drawn by Yulia, the animator, and Elle and Katie have done a fantastic job with it. And it's certainly something I'm very proud to be working on. And, I think that some of the quandaries and some of the things that we're trying to highlight is telling the story through Jennifer's children, who are now adults. Well, that's a unique and pioneering aspect to it, but also just the dilemma that Jennifer faced of escaping, but knowing that if she stayed, she died, and if she left, she died. So, what are her options? And the fact that so many people say, well, why don't they leave? Why doesn't the woman, the victim, leave? And that tells me everything that somebody doesn't understand that they are facing. If they stay, they die. They leave, they die, because no one can protect them 24/7. And it explores that narrative, along with the fact the professionals actually put her and her children further at risk. And that is happening every day across the country and across the world, where professionals who are not trained don't understand really the risks that someone like Jennifer faces. So being able to bring that to the mass screen through the children's voices, and there's this very poignant moment where David, the son, says about the murder. I don't know if he thought it was right, but he thought it was his right. And that to me really sums it up, the entitlement aspect of somebody who feels that they own another person and the dangerousness of that situation. And Jennifer well understood the danger that she was facing. So we're really trying to bring that to the screen for a mass audience. And I'm really excited about this project. And I really feel, I call it a project, but Jennifer's voice needs to be out there. We need to tell this story, and her children feel we need to tell this story and honor Jennifer so that it's not Scott, it's not the abuser who has the last word in this. And Jennifer is instrumental for me also, because not just because her, it could be anybody anywhere, but she's also the voice of the coercive control law reform campaign in America, where we have introduced a new law in New York. And I'm really, pleased that there we're starting to make some progress, and Jennifer and her is the voice of it, as are her children, and also talking with legislators here in California. So, there is a campaign that people can support too, and being able to educate people through Jennifer, through her voice, through her children, is a very important part of saying on a bigger platform, we don't have to accept this. There's much more we can do to keep people safe, and law change is one key component of that.
I wonder if you can, I know you have to go pretty soon. But I just wanted to talk about some specifics around what can be done in order to deal with coercive control in relationships. You know, what do professionals need to be doing when they're dealing with people, you know, like Jennifer? What should be done in terms of legislation?
Well, I think firstly, you know, it's important for professionals to understand that when they're interacting with a victim of domestic abuse, they're going to be hearing the perpetrator's voice. So the first thing is understanding that dynamic and ensuring that they get trained on coercive control. And knowing and understanding that it's a pattern, that when they reach out to you, this isn't the first time. And as Elle said with Jennifer, 15 years she had been abused in every way, 15 years. It wasn't an overnight thing. So again, when professionals respond, and I'm talking specifically to police now, it's not an incident. It's not a one-off. So they need to get that into their heads, that they need to be thinking about what's gone before and what will come future. And that's really where law reform is important, because legislation pretty much all over the world says in the legislative framework, it is an incident, and you look for the physical behaviour or evidence to prove the incident. And so straight away, you've got a rub between we know it's a pattern and now they're attending an incident and they're looking for physical evidence, which isn't always available when we're talking about coercive control. So that part of law reform is important. With stalking, changing the law on stalking in England and Wales, straight away we put into the legislation, it's a pattern of behaviour. So people know to look for the history. But if you just deal with this as a one-off thing and you don't take everything of the 15 years into account, you're dealing with the tip of the spear and not everything before that. And that tip of the spear could be, you know, at the culmination of events where someone does separate and it's the most dangerous time, which most murders happen at the point of separation. So saying to somebody, why don't you leave, actually makes it clear that they've not been trained to understand domestic abuse and coercive control, and that it is the most significant indicator of homicide. So I think the law reform part is a key aspect, because it explains and makes it clear in law what's acceptable and what's not. And it means that you can hold abusers to account. And that's the part that's not happening. That if somebody gets a slap on the wrist, well, the victim knows they're going to be back at the address, and they know that the police can't protect them 24/7. So what choice do they have? That's normally where they will withdraw and not support a prosecution, which if you're looking down the barrel of a gun, that's probably what you're going to do. And I mean that metaphorically, that you have to manage that relationship when the police are no longer there or when they're not willing to do anything. And if they're not willing to do anything and the perpetrator comes straight back out, the message to the victim is, my freedom is more important than your safety, and I am more powerful than the system. So you better watch out. That's the message to the victim.
That's right.
So I think that part is the bit that gets overlooked the most. And, you know, law changes, coercive control law reform change, which again on Twitter I've tweeted, and I'll make sure that you have just for the show notes the petition that people can sign. But it's also ensuring that serial abusers and stalkers are placed on a register, and expanding out the sex offenders register. In England and Wales, we have the violent and sexual offenders register. So it already exists, sexual and violent offenders. But people just drop out the violent. And with violent, I'm talking about psychological and coercive. I'm not just talking physical. And the problem is, if someone gets away with something, and I ask this question in training to police all the time, what happens when someone gets away with something? And they will say they do it again. And I say, and then what happens? Well, they do it again and it escalates. And I say, yes. And then what happens? Well, something serious happens, serious harm or murder. And I say, yes. And then what happens? We have a homicide review. We review the process and we say this mustn't happen again until the next time. So again, this isn't rocket science. A lot of this is my experiential learning and research from when I worked at New Scotland Yard and profiled thousands of perpetrators and murders, and drawing out from the cases, from what victims and survivors say, and from the murders, of what needs to change. And I do think it's about ensuring that this is a criminal issue. You know, the soft approach on it does not work. There has to be a serious repercussion, a fear of a consequence for a perpetrator to change their behavior. At that end, you have to close down the perpetrator's space and hold them to account, just like they do to the victim. And at the end of, you know, younger people, educating them about what a healthy relationship looks like. So it's not do one thing and that's it. It's and. I don't know if you want to add to that, Elle, or...
I just want to build on that too and saying, like, I think in some sense what's needed is a reorientation of our approach to domestic violence. I mean, it's a $1 trillion, you know, industrial complex addressing DV. And I think we are extremely focused at the moment on managing the women. We shuffle the women off to shelters, disrupt their lives, put them in lockdown, you know, take them out of their earning positions and, you know, disrupt their whole both economy and everything else. And more often than not, the perpetrators are left completely mobile and
To do what they want with impunity.
To do exactly what they want. And so while the women hide underground, so to speak, it really should be the reverse, you know, where the men are taken out of the situation in some form or fashion and women are left to carry on with their lives.
Mm-hmm. And finally, before we wrap up, when will Jennifer 42 be released and how can people watch it?
So we're basically mid-production with a hoped for release date of April of next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you so much for talking with me today about this. This is such an important issue, and I'm so glad that you both are working so hard to bring attention to this and to affect change.
You're welcome, and thank you for having us on. And there's just one thing I would like to cover, if you don't mind, Megan, which is mm-hmm. just something that lots of, you know, women do ask me about, which is just what some of the red flags are to watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think that preventative aspect and empowering people is an important part of this narrative. You know, because in most cases, and certainly when I think about the murders and women that I work with, they intuitively knew that there was a problem. Yeah, in their gut. And sometimes we deny it and we ignore what our instinct is telling us about someone. And just in the day and age of, you know, online dating, which most people do online date now, you know, like with John Meehan, I think it's important just to highlight some of I call them red flags. So the first is sort of the whirlwind relationship, you know, when things happen really quickly and someone's accelerating the relationship. And I always say, just take your time. There's no fire. There's no need to move things that you spend each night with each other or each day. The courting part of a relationship is the most exciting, because if you stop doing everything that you did before, you are isolating yourself. And if someone's tying up all your time, again, that's indicative of love bombing. So just slow things down and be conscious of I call it the pedestal syndrome, where someone puts you on a pedestal. You know, where they're so attentive, they listen to everything you say, and perhaps in your last relationship you weren't listened to. But anyone who's put on a pedestal normally comes crashing down at some point. So watch out for that. And also even that attentiveness, you know, some people confuse attention versus control. So always question, is it attentiveness? Is it good? Is it healthy? Or is it controlling behavior? And if you have that kind of instinct like Deborah did, they're too good to be true, well, follow that and question that, because someone who is too good to be true normally is. So that's where we go back to trusting your instinct. And just a little bit of trivia, a true piece of trivia, is that we have more brain cells in our gut, in our stomach, than a dog has in their heads. You know, I love dogs, so I try and bring them into the conversation, but we have, you know, our guts that we sometimes override. And don't ignore it, because when there's a red flag and when there's something that's tweaking or your instinct's tweaking, that's for purpose. It's a survival mechanism. So again, watching out for love bombing, someone who's charming, you know, that charm offensive. Gaslighting, when you know something to be right and maybe they distort it or change something, or inserting in your relationships, or preventing you from doing something, or limiting you in any way. And a good question I always ask, you know, or say to people when they're starting dating, is listen to how he describes his relationship with his exes. You know, if someone's saying, oh, they're crazy, or putting that person down, or saying very negative things, then that to me is normally a red flag. Or, you know, equally ask them how relationships ended, because that can really be a tell about the person that you're getting involved with. So again, there's very key questions. I always say, if you're online dating, treat it like a business interview. You know, you are thinking about investing your everything in somebody, then you want to make sure that you really understand who you're about to invest with, or in, should I say. You know, things are going slightly, going to a point where you're feeling uncomfortable, talk to someone about it. Don't sit there in isolation and allow them to silence your voice. Talk to someone who you trust. But, you know, too often people don't do that, unfortunately. And before they know it, they're isolated and they've lost their friends, their family and people around them. So, again, it's when we do see those red flags, people should really be thinking about what's a red flag and what's a deal breaker. You know, and once those deal breakers, and being clear what your deal breakers are, you know, some people really do have a lucky escape. They don't realize it at the time. But that's why I always say, always, always trust your instinct. So that's just a kind of a quick whistle stop tour of just some of the red flags that I see across cases, and to think about when you are starting to date someone and taking that next step into a commitment with somebody. It's the biggest investment you will make.
Yeah, that's a really important point. So thanks so much for adding that. And again, thank you both for talking with me today. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Megan, so much. Yeah, thank you for having us on.
You just heard an interview with Elle Kamihira and Laura Richards. To learn more about the film, Jennifer 42, visit jennifer42movie.com. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Show the world radical feminism is worth listening to. Feminist Current is produced and edited by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.